Hi, I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is the Marketplace Weekend Podcast for the weekend of November 21st, 2014. Going home to family, friends, a familiar meal has such a universal through line. It's about comfort, the familiar, the worn grooves you return to after you've pushed your way out into the world. Maybe after a long day at work, mashed potatoes are kind of soothing. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy collides with real life. Our show this week is about comfort, what we turn to before Thanksgiving, or how we build a comfortable identity in a sometimes confusing world, even the stuff we accumulate to be materially comfortable, or think we are. We want to hear about what comforts you. You can write us at marketplaceweekend.org or reach us on Twitter. We're at MarketplaceWKND. Now let's start the show and round up your economic week in 20 seconds.
It was a cliffhanger this evening, but Senate Democrats voted to kill the Keystone XL pipeline.
The Nikkei down almost 3% after the latest reading on Japan's economy. The GDP there shows that the country fell back into recession.
So the breaking news is we got unemployment figures. It was 287 for the weekly jobless claims, right?
287,000 new Americans filed for unemployment benefits. That's in the grand scheme in the longer term, a pretty good number.
We're going to start our stories of comfort with one about learning to feel comfortable with who you are, finding your feet, if you will, as a new generation, Generation Z. That's the group younger than millennials. Marketplace and Northeastern University teamed up to poll more than 1,000 members of this group to learn what they think, want, fear, and hope for. Marketplace's education correspondent Amy Scott joins us now from WYPR in Baltimore to explain more about Generation Z. Hi, Amy. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Lizzie.
Amy, you've been reporting on Generation Z. I have to admit, I did not know they were a thing. What is Generation Z?
Well, roughly speaking, it's kids born since about 1995, and this has also been called the I generation or the plurals. You're not alone in not having heard of this. Even some of the kids I talked to from this generation didn't know what that meant. We teamed up with Northeastern University to survey about 1,000 16 to 19-year-olds. And basically, as you'd expect, this is a tech-savvy bunch. They're entrepreneurial, socially progressive. They believe in things like marriage equality and free health care. They're worried about the income gap in this country. And they're just starting to hit college, which is why we wanted to see, you know, what does this next wave of college students look like? Most of them plan to attend at least some college right after high school because they've been told it's the only path to a good career. They're very concerned, though, about how to pay for it. In fact, more than any other scary thing we ask them about, including terrorism, climate change, even, you know, having enough money, they're not realistic about how they will pay for it. A third told us that grants and scholarships would be the main way that they pay for college. But in reality, only 0.3% of students really get enough grants and scholarships to cover the full cost.
Wow, that's a big gap there. What do you think is the reason for that gap? Is that just sort of ignorance about how the funding system for college works?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it is that they're teenagers and they have, like many in our society, a lack of real financial literacy. But also, this is a generation that's extremely debt averse. They grew up, you know, watching their parents struggle in the Great Recession. Here's how a group of students that I talked to at Bethesda Chevy Chase High School outside D.C. reacted when I brought up student loans.
I don't want any loans. Last resort.
It's not worth the debt.
So that was pretty unanimous. That was Tiffany and Tamara King, twin sisters, by the way, Adam Mangani and Alexandra Holler, who are all seniors at the high school. But I think, as you mentioned, part of this is just confusion about the way college prices work. I mean, on one hand, you've got the sticker price, which is rising, but colleges do offer a lot of financial aid to mark that down to compete for students. But there's only so much to go around. But I also talked to an analyst, Heather O'Leary, with the research firm Edge Ventures, and she says there may be a cultural element, too.
And it also, you know, falls to parents who have been telling them, you know, from a very early age, they're all very special snowflakes and they should be recognized for that individuality.
And, you know, that gets back to this idea that these days everyone gets a trophy. As O'Leary said, there's no honorable mention anymore.
That's Heather O'Leary, no relation. If they're thinking about college, are they thinking at all about what comes next? And how worried are they about sort of looking out past education to how to get a job and what happens after all their school?
Yeah, they are very concerned about finding jobs. About 64% said they were worried about it. 60% said they were worried about having enough money to support their families. And that translates, I think, into a really pragmatic approach to going to college. They expect colleges to prepare them for careers. They want to have practical experience through things like internships. They want to take courses on entrepreneurship and how to start a business. And I think one of the most interesting findings was that 42% of them expect to work for themselves during their careers. And that's compared to 11% of American workers who actually do work for themselves. And I think there are a couple ways to read that. You know, it may, again, be that sort of overconfidence. But also, I think it reflects, you know, a hangover from the recession and perhaps a deep suspicion of the corporations that they've seen lay off, you know, thousands of workers. And in fact, 64% said they think big corporations and banks have too much control in our society.
Our education correspondent, Amy Scott, coming to us from WIPR. Amy, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on.
Every day, you and I interact with the world of tech.
Today, we're going to be showing our friends the basics of technology.
Hey, Mike found a map!
Yeah.
Hey, look, that says 1632. Is that a year or something?
No, it's your top score on pole position.
Yes, it's a year, Chuck. Look, it's a map of our coastline.
This is tech in real life.
Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Lizzie. It doesn't get much more real than trying to drive through Manhattan, right? Which is where we are right now.
We are in the back of a car.
Yes, we're in the back of a car. Dan Semitovich, senior producer, is being patient behind the wheel.
So what are we doing here in the back of the car?
We're going to look at dynamic mapping. Now, dynamic mapping sounds fancy, right? But really what we're doing right now is we're playing with this app Waze. That's Waze with a Z, of course. We're sort of like in the golden age of mapping right now. Lots of companies are getting very good at this. Apple, after a pretty bad start, has some good mapping technology. Google, of course, is the big player in this game. And Waze, which, by the way, is owned by Google, Waze, it sort of gamifies this stuff for users. It wants users to interact with the map. It wants users to report things. You can see over here, we were looking before, somewhere over here, there's actually a cop. Someone has reported that there is a cop. So Waze promises this kind of live updating map that tells you where the cops are.
It
tells
and here you it says tons and tons of traffic on 57th and Park. We do not want to go over there.
Don't go over to 57th and Park. Exactly.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 icons for bad traffic.
Right. And so this is what's interesting, right? Mapping is more and more using the data of users. In the example of Waze, of course, there's actually the option to actually comment and say, hey, look, there's a cop over here. Watch out. There's a speed trap over here. Watch out. Or there's an accident that I just saw on the FDR. Just heads up. And that's, I think, leading to actually smarter maps.
Looking at these maps and all these little icons, sure. Are they always right, or are there flaws here? Do I trust these little moving dots, or do I look out in front of me and trust my eyes?
Well, hopefully if you're driving, you're looking
right.
out in front
looking
of you
looking
all
in front
the
anyway,
time.
Right.
But basically, these maps are most of the time just trying to give you the fastest route. And that may not always feel right? Maybe the map will try and get you to get off on an exit, or they'll try and send you away that you don't usually go. Sometimes speed can actually be pretty inconvenient. For instance, when I head up north into New England, as I often do, I basically avoid the hellscape that is I-95 because I hate it.
Because it's terrible.
It's terrible. And actually, in my experience, it's also more prone to accidents and traffic jams. So on average, it may be faster. But in my own anecdotal experience, I want to avoid it at all costs.
When you look at these maps in total, why are they kind of on aggregate accurate?
The thing that's really interesting about these maps is that most of the information comes from other drivers. If a user allows an app like Apple Maps or Google Maps to use their location data, they're providing data about where they are all the time and how fast they're moving. Mapping companies rely on this information to report on traffic, and they also make, I think, admirable efforts to anonymize that data. Google, interestingly, also relies on historical data to make predictions about the traffic at various times of day. So, like, if we're leaving for our Thanksgiving weekend, for instance, Google will not only be using the real-time traffic data, but it will also be using kind of historical context, if you will, about how long it usually takes.
So it will know that Wednesday afternoon is a terrible, terrible time to drive.
Terrible time to get in the car.
Got it.
Now, all of this is technically free?
Yes, but you know the saying, Lizzie, right? If the service is free, then the user is the product.
Right.
So one thing that's interesting is a lot of these map apps are really wanting to, I think, figure out a way to market to the user. Some of these map companies have been known to trade data with local governments. Waze, for instance, gets sensor and camera information from partners like municipalities, like Rio, for instance, the state of Florida. Other apps make money directly for tracking their users. There's a biking app, for instance, called Strava that makes 80 cents per tracked user from municipalities who want to improve their own database. So at the end of the day, yes, your data is being bought and sold by these apps. Sometimes it's effectively anonymized, sometimes not, but it is something that you want to think about. If you turn location reporting off, the app does work worse for you, the user, and it also works worse in the aggregate because it's not getting as much information. So they kind of have you in between a rock and a hard place if you really want to use mapping and get all the benefits.
Ben Johnson, host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Lizzie.
This week, we're talking about comfort, and that can manifest in a lot of ways, including being comfortable coming out at work. This past week, the Human Rights Campaign, the nation's largest LGBT rights organization, released its Corporate Equality Index. That's a measure of how Fortune 500 companies treat lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender employees in the workplace. Things have changed a lot over the 10-plus years the group has released its annual report. Same-sex marriage is now legal in more than 30 states. There are more rights for LGBT people in the workplace, and many big businesses have increased their protections for employees, including non-discrimination clauses and partner benefits. One of the Human Rights Campaign's arguments is that an LGBT-friendly workplace and benefits are good business. I spoke with their director of workplace equality, Dina Fidas, about the decision to be out or not at work and how that affects both employees and the companies they work for.
In the last decade, decade and a half of our work, so many businesses have come to the realization that being an LGBT inclusive employer isn't just the right thing to do, it's actually smart business. And so we've seen a tremendous amount of tangible progress with a majority, for example, of the Fortune 500 having specific workplace protections in place on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity. Despite all of this incredible change in terms of policies and partner benefits, still a little over half of all lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender workers in this country remain closeted on the job. And so quite literally, people are getting married on the weekends and not talking about it come Monday morning.
You have written about the cost of being closeted
Put it in numbers.
We aggregated several factors that fit broadly under what's known as employee engagement. So essentially, how enthusiastic are you about your job? And we saw an aggregated drop of approximately 30% in employee engagement that really is owed to the closet, or in some cases, what we would note are unwelcoming work environments. In other words, somebody is out. They're out about their LGBT identity, but they're feeling that sense of isolation.
How do you square your advocacy work with the law? I mean, 29 states don't have any explicit laws protecting people from workplace discrimination based on sexual orientation. So you can say, well, there are costs to staying in the closet, but oh my goodness, if you're going to lose your job, that seems like a huge potential cost to coming out.
For sure, the legal environment has an impact on people's decisions to be out in the workplace. And, you know, taking a step back, we hear so much, for example, about millennials. You know, this is the generation that's the most out. It's almost a non-issue. And yet, in our research, we find that actually many of the youngest workers are out to their friends and family. They're out in their school environments, and they're actually going back in the closet when they get their first jobs. And that's because they don't feel that they necessarily have that professional profile, and they don't feel able to bring their whole selves to their first jobs. And so certainly, to answer your question directly, it's the legal environment, but it's also the everyday environment. Many of our survey respondents noted that they feared they would lose connections with their coworkers, they would make people feel uncomfortable, and really citing that more nuanced daily reality of what it means to be accepted or what it means to be given, you know, maybe less overt signals that, hey, you're welcome here, but we'd like you to hang up a certain part of you at the door when you come into the office.
When you talk about millennials who are maybe going back in the closet, what are they losing out on if they do that at work? Are they cutting themselves off from some of maybe those mentoring relationships?
By nature, a lot of mentoring relationships go beyond the work at hand. In other words, your mentor is somebody who you can confide in, you can talk about personal struggles, and this is where we get into a bit of a catch-22. If you are 23 years old and in your first job and you overhear the guys at the coffee machine making wisecracks about gay people, you're simultaneously thinking, well, am I really accepted here as an out gay person? Well, maybe not. It would be that very conversation you'd want to have with a mentor. And so I think that's where you see a bit of a cycle taking place. At the same time, particularly amongst the larger businesses, these LGBT, or sometimes called LGBT and allied affinity groups, provide a tremendously effective platform for young people to find a mentor.
There was a recent study from Princeton that said coming out on your resume can be beneficial, or at least harmless. They cited for African-American men in particular. Have you found this to be true?
It really just depends. On the one hand, we hear back from people whose decision to be out on their resume was both tied to their skill sets. You know, I wanted to demonstrate that I took this leadership role in a network group, but also as a way to, in no uncertain terms, communicate with a prospective employer. My expectation is that everything I'm bringing to the table, including my LGBT identity, is something that I want to be valued here. At the same time, we also know from our research that bias happens, whether it's conscious or unconscious.
So some kid comes to you and says, what do I do? Do I come out at work? Is it always a yes or?
It's a conversation. It's a conversation as to, one, is there any reason why from day one you didn't feel that you could bring this part of your identity to the workplace? And then from there, we can talk a bit more concretely.
Dina Fadas is the director of the Human Rights Campaign's Workplace Equality Program. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much.
To get a better sense of people's experience in the workplace, we spoke with a few people about coming out at their jobs. There is, of course, no one portrait of what it's like to come out and be out at work, but here's a look. Sam Ritchie is an online communications manager at the Innocence Project. For him, being out is fairly simple.
I've been out pretty much since high school, so I never really had a formal coming out process. and I just start talking about my life. I talk about boyfriends or when I was married, my husband, and people just pick up on it. I work in nonprofit, and so I've had a lot of jobs for LGBT organizations. So I just joke that it's being professionally gay to work for those kinds of places. I do sort of try to get a feel that it would be a welcoming place. I certainly wouldn't go somewhere that seemed like it would be closed or closed-minded or where I would feel like I'd have to hide that part of myself. I definitely feel closer to people because I'm able to be honest about my life. I mean, if I wasn't able to talk about my personal life, I feel like I would come across as very guarded and not, you know, friendly or you know, open with people.
Anne Marie Whalen is an oncology nurse. Being out to her coworkers is important to her. But with her patients, things are different.
I don't come out to my patients because we're in this sort of power dynamic where I have a lot of control over their lives. I'm the one who is responsible to make sure that they're okay and that they get their medications and that, you know, they get their dressings changed and they get the care that they need. And that I'm the person who is looking out for them and making sure that they stay safe. So I want to make sure that they feel comfortable with me, and I don't want to risk coming out to somebody and then having them have a problem with the fact that I'm gay and having that damage the trust that they have in me as their nurse. I work 13-hour shifts, so like you spend a lot of time with the same people, and so it's definitely nice if you can be friends with your coworkers instead of just seeing them at work. And I feel like being out at work allows me to do that.
Josie Simonis says that for her, being out isn't really a choice. But if it were, she says she'd still choose visibility.
At the very top of my CV is my full legal name, which is Joseph Simonis. And then underneath that, I typically go by Josie, and so that's listed. But then also two are my personal pronouns. So I use either she or they pronouns, and that's listed right at the top. I actually don't have a choice in terms of whether or not I'm out in the workplace or really anywhere in my life. I'm pretty visible in terms of being trans. Being out at work has definitely allowed me to be more comfortable with who I am and bring more of myself to work on a regular basis. It's also afforded me lots of opportunities to be mentored and to be a mentor to others, which allows me to be more comfortable and feel more engaged, both with my workplace and with my colleagues as well.
And that brings us to the weekend number, 366. That's the number of Fortune 500 businesses with a perfect score on this year's Corporate Equality Index. That's up from 13 in 2002, the first year the report was published. If you had to name a place where the comforts of home, really homes themselves, have gotten incredibly expensive, you might say New York, San Francisco, maybe London. Well, how about Windhoek? The capital of Namibia in southern Africa has just recorded the second fastest rate of house price growth in the world. The BBC's Temesun Ford reports from there.
33-year-old Zadidi Garseb shows me around her rented apartment. It doesn't take long.
Okay, we are in the kitchen area right now with a small living room area, tiny little passageway.
Tiny corridor here.
And yes, the kids' bedroom, which is also quite small, but...
But it's all you can afford.
Yeah, it is really all I can afford.
So Didi is educated. She has a good job as an events manager in the capital. She earns above the average salary. But still, she can't afford to buy a house in her home city. And she can't afford to rent anything bigger than this.
It is very frustrating. And I'm not just speaking for myself, I'm speaking for my friends. You feel like you are working so hard and you've studied and you've checked all the boxes, basically, to be able to afford a simple thing such as housing, but the market just does not allow it.
House prices across the entire country are increasing by almost 30% every year, pushing rental costs up too. But salaries just aren't keeping up. Namini Khalili is the manager of research and development at Namibia's First National Bank.
Okay, so the latest quarterly figures show that Namibia has the second highest house price inflation in the world, and it's a story of just supply and demand. There's just way too much demand in the market, and the supply is battling to catch up.
Namibia is one of the least populated countries in the world, and the one thing it does have is an abundance of land. But government housing is scarce and is not being built quickly enough. As for private contractors, they are developing, but largely for the high-income earners, pushing graduates and first-time buyers out of the market even further. One of them is Finkenstein, a new 500-unit housing development on the outskirts of the city. Dion House is the trustee. He says supply and demand is not the only problem.
The availability of land in the Windhoek Basin is problematic. The high cost of imported building materials, and then the rules and regulations of the relevant authorities that make it difficult for developers to do what they are supposed to do and what they want to do.
However, it's the people, not the developers, who are suffering. I'm standing on the edge of a place called Tin City. It's an informal housing settlement sprawled out along the hills at the edge of the city. It's made almost entirely of corrugated iron shacks. Now, because of the high cost of housing, more and more young professionals, your teachers, doctors and nurses, are being forced out of the housing market and are having to live in areas like this where there is little electricity and no running water. And as house prices rise, so do the number of informal settlements. First National Bank is warning if something's not done soon, Windhoek could turn into a slum city.
Shacks are going to start jumping into all kinds of neighbourhoods, even the high-income neighbourhoods, and those speculators are benefiting now while 5 years down the line, you might find a shack next door to you, and that's going to bring down your property prices, and then we'll see who's smiling then.
To be able to afford an average property in Namibia, household incomes need to triple, and that just isn't happening. For people like Zididi, it means high rents and a fear they may never get on the housing ladder.
What's even more frustrating is that nothing has been done about it. The prices are just increasing and increasing year after year, and it's not a nice situation. It's horrible.
That story comes to us from our partners at the BBC. Uncomfortable. Does talking about money at the family holiday table make you squirm? Or is it the right time to maybe push someone to have that retirement talk? We took our etiquette questions to our in-house experts, part of the APM family, the hosts of the Dinner Party Download, Rico Galliano and Brendan Francis Noonan. Welcome to Marketplace Weekend, guys.
Well, thank you for inviting us, Lizzie. We're honored to be here.
It's lovely to be dining at your table today.
Around the table, we observe some sort of etiquette. You guys talk etiquette on your show.
Mm-hmm.
I want to get a little uncomfortable.
Okay.
Really?
Yeah.
We can oblige.
Here, put on this chainmail vest.
I want to bring up the topic of money, whether or not you should talk about your finances at Thanksgiving.
Mm-hmm. People are uncomfortable talking about money. That's how they've been raised.
We say, and we tend to say this about all topics, is that, you know, a dinner is a fine time to talk about anything. Nothing should be off the table, and because basically dinner parties are kind of microcosms of society, and how is society to get better if we don't talk about these things? However, this is Thanksgiving dinner, and the nice thing about Thanksgiving dinner is that, you know, it brings families together for extended periods of time that maybe don't get to spend extended periods of time together. Maybe you live from out of town. Maybe even if you're in the same city, you're very busy. So there are plenty of times around Thanksgiving dinner,
yeah,
that you could maybe talk. This seems like maybe a dishwashing conversation.
Or a pre-dinner drink conversation.
There's also, I mean, you know, Thanksgiving, there are so many weird dynamics that play out at everybody's table, whether it's the uncle who drank too much or the political argument that goes crazy. Yeah, that's you. Okay. I know that my mother does not want to have this conversation with me, but I also know that it is one that I need to start with her.
Money is the source of great anxiety for lots of people.
Yeah.
It actually undermines lots of relationships. Mm-hmm. If you don't talk about things, people have a distorted sense of people's financial situation, which can just lead to more anxiety.
By the way, something that occurs to me is that the nice thing about any holiday is that it is kind of a milestone. You kind of mark time with these things. You mark time with your family. And it does make sense as a check-in point. It's a time where you're almost sure that you are going to be together with your family. And it makes sense to maybe talk about the future, the next time that you're going to be together, what things might be like then. And what your goals are.
But Rico, you have lied to your family about money.
Oh, yeah. I had this moment right after college where I was living with a bunch of slackers, and the deal was that I could move in and pay very little rent and no utility bills. And I thought that was a great deal until I realized
no red flags there.
Yeah, right. Really, nobody was paying utility bills, so no utility bills got paid. So my utilities kept going out, which I definitely hid from my parents until the point where they needed to call me for an emergency, and they couldn't because my phone was out. There was no phone service.
So, you know, there are consequences to not discussing these things.
Precisely.
Brendan Francis Noonan, Rico Galliano, hosts of the Dinner Party Download, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having us, Lizzie.
Thank you so much.
Last week, we asked you to share your stories of the economics behind the ultimate comfort meal, Thanksgiving dinner. How much you pay for your turkey, or whether you have plans for your leftovers. Well, here are some answers.
Turkey, my $10.
My wife usually buys it.
My grandmother is buying the turkey.
I get discounts from my job, and they give us like half off on turkey, so.
My husband works at Costco, so he gets it for free.
Actually, I kind of live alone. I'm going to eat out, so I'm not going to spend a buck on a turkey.
Between $20 and $30.
The leftovers, I'm just going to...
We eat it the next day.
I'll probably make a sandwich or something.
And the soup. We'll make the soup. Everybody will eat the soup.
We'll, like, refry some stuffing with it.
Make a soup out of the bone.
We'll eat them probably for the whole week.
Possibly some kind of pot pie.
What else do I do?
Sandwiches.
Turkey sandwiches.
Make sandwiches.
Usually make turkey sandwiches for the next 2 weeks or so.
I guess we need to be more creative.
We just eat them again. That's pretty much it.
Thanks to all of the people who talked to us on the streets of Los Angeles. We could all probably use some help planning and budgeting for Thanksgiving, so we asked Lynn Rossetto Casper to join us. She's also part of the APM family and hosts The Splendid Table. Lynn, it's great to have you with us.
Good to be with you guys.
So you've been hosting The Splendid Table since 1994. That's 20 years. I mean, wow. But I want to know what you have learned about how to host a Thanksgiving, because that sounds, I have to admit, completely daunting to me.
I've always had fantasies that I would have the absolutely perfect table and every single thing that was cooked would be brilliant. And then I learned something about entertaining, and this really was the turning point for me. You know what? It's not about us. It's really not about us. It's not about the host. It's about the guests. Before you sit down at a table, okay, never have enough chairs wherever you're milling around having drinks or whatever. Never have enough chairs.
Really? That's so sneaky.
Well, they have to stand up and they have to mix.
Thanksgiving can be daunting. It can also be really expensive. Do you think people should start out by, you know, making a budget and mapping out kind of what they need to get and what they need to do?
I think the key to this is organize, organize, organize. You're absolutely right. Map it out and look at what you really would like to serve. And then look at what it's the reality of what it's going to cost. The turkey may be the visual centerpiece of Thanksgiving, but Thanksgiving is all about the sides. And most of the time, the sides have all kinds of flavors. And the turkey becomes A, carrier for gravy, and B, some little bit of protein you tuck in your mouth. Think critically for about 2 minutes that she overcooked the breast. And then you move on to the mashed potatoes, the sweet potatoes, the beautiful curried Brussels sprouts, and the, you know, whatever it may be. If you're tight for cash, the frozen supermarket turkey, 99 cents a pound, is the way to go. And oh, the other place to save money is wine. There are so many really good wines that are so reasonably priced. One of my favorite white wines with this kind of meal ranges between $5.99 and $6.99. It's from Portugal. It's a Vino Verde, and it's called Pavao, P-A-V-E-O.
How long do your leftovers tend to last you, do you think?
6 months. I'm kidding. No, but I freeze some things. I freeze some things because there is a point where you can't face a turkey anymore or any form of turkey. Anything I can freeze, the roasted vegetables, the Brussels sprouts, that kind of thing, I freeze. And the stuffing, I freeze. And I freeze it in small quantities because I'll always come up with something I can do with it.
And I know that this is not people's priority, maybe with their leftovers, but man, this is all sort of great. Cut a little money here, cut a little money there.
Yeah, exactly. And you can live off of that for quite a while.
I love leftovers. I imagine a lot of people do, too. What do you usually do with yours?
I adore leftovers. I mean, I plan around leftovers. First of all, the turkey sandwich. The turkey sandwich that has to have, you have to make extra stuffing. And my stuffing is something I make. It's almost, it could be a main dish. Let's put it that way. I like to take that and cut it into slices and pan fry it. This is bread on bread. I toast a really good ciabatta roll and slather it with a bit of olive oil and then pan fry a thin slice of the stuffing with a bit of olive oil. Try to hold it together because it's crumbly and whatever. And then on top of that goes cold turkey. And on top of that goes a bit of just a moistening of warm gravy. And on top of that goes some of my homemade cranberry relish. It melt. You can't get it in your mouth without it sliding and dripping, but it is the best darn turkey sandwich. The other thing is I love to make roasted vegetables because they're so easy to reheat on Thanksgiving Day, and I can do them a day ahead. And all the leftover roasted vegetables end up going into a pot of broth, or they actually get cooked with the turkey bones and scraps to make broth. And I strain that. It's just delicious, the flavor of that broth. And then what I can make with that broth is the Vietnamese soup pho.
Lynn Rosetter-Casper, host of The Splendid Table, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, and you have a great Thanksgiving.
You too. Tune in to Turkey Confidential this Thanksgiving morning for more from Lynn. And you can visit splendidtable.org for recipes, advice, and tips. Next week, the holidays are a season for giving. Many of you are buying gifts, donating to charity, helping someone, or someone's helping you. And we want to hear your stories. How do you balance helping others with your personal financial needs? Tell us by visiting MarketplaceWeekend.org, Marketplace's Facebook page, or you can tweet us. We're at Marketplace WKND. While you may be enjoying the comfort of your family dinner, 1 in 4 employed Americans will work on either Thanksgiving, Christmas, or New Year's Day this year. That's according to a poll by National Journal and Allstate. It's especially true at big retail stores, where Black Friday kicks off the holiday shopping season. We went to meet one of those employees to find out what it's like to spend your holiday working the floor of a big box store. We are at the Best Buy on 62nd Street and Broadway in New York, and I'm with
Cy Paulson, the general manager of the Best Buy store here on the Upper West Side.
What's the store like on Thanksgiving?
There's a lot of retail adrenaline. that comes, and it's pretty intoxicating.
What time are you open?
On Thanksgiving, we open at 5 p.m., and we stay open until 1 a.m., and then we close and reopen the next morning, Black Friday at 8 a.m.
I was looking into some of the Black Friday numbers, and I'm amazed by how many men go nuts on Black Friday. I don't want to overgeneralize here, but I feel like your store is like man candyland.
This is my dad's 10th Black Friday shopping in the store that I work in as a customer with Black Friday. The category in general, you know, maybe it's just that's something even beyond Best Buy in terms of, you know, who's really digging consumer electronics. You know, I don't know if you're a big, like, Call of Duty fan, but, you know, you might know someone that is.
The media hypes Black Friday. You guys hype Black Friday. Is it that different?
It is different in that, you know, it is hyped. Since our customers are so into it, you know, it does make the day at least feel a little bit different.
I think about the hours in a Thanksgiving day, and, you know, by 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock, your average person has maybe got a glass of wine or a beer, they're watching football, they're disagreeing with their uncle about something. What are you doing then?
We open at 5, so our customers will line up waiting to get in for that 5 p.m. open as early as a day or two before. And there's already reports in California of a customer waiting. First person in line is ready to go for their Thanksgiving deals. What I'm doing before the store opens is the simple term would be schmoozing with the crowd, talking to them, seeing what they're about. We will have a line to enter the building until, you know, the wee hours of the night.
Wow.
A lot of what I'm doing is making sure that that line and that process of crowd entry is going smoothly. And then I make sure coordinating with my leaders. I work in a 3-level Best Buy, so we communicate every minute to make sure that the flow on each level is going smoothly. So to answer your question, I'm very busy between 5 and 6.
Do you ever miss your family?
Oh, for sure. You know, my mom will say, like, I don't care when I see you, I just want to see you. So, you know, that kind of makes me feel better.
How do you get your marching orders on a, you know, great big weekend like this?
So I went to a meeting where they fly all of the general managers out last month, and we get our strategy, our marketing efforts, our et cetera, around what our stores should be going after. And then ultimately, I get to decide how we're going to do that here on the Upper West Side of Manhattan.
When I was out there walking around on the floor, I mean, the closest analogy my brain can draw is having been on a military base and watching, like, large amounts of stuff get ready to get moved.
Mm-hmm.
Walk me through just the preparation for a weekend like Thanksgiving, Black Friday. You know, what goes into that from a stuff-moving perspective?
We see how much we're getting in, and we know with our experience, right, how big a, let's say, 40-inch TV, what physical room that takes up. And then we look at our store map, and we draw little X's, and we say, well, this TV will be placed here. This computer will be placed here, this tablet, et cetera. If you go into any Best Buy store today, you will feel like there is a lot of stock.
How many Thanksgivings have you worked?
This will be my 10th Thanksgiving holiday season, number 10.
And does that mean no Thanksgiving dinner for you?
I've become predisposed towards liking leftovers more than like the actual meal. There's two groups of people that really, really want to know what time we were going to be open. Obviously, the employees and the staff here, number one. And the second one was my mom. Your family wants to be with you on Thanksgiving.
Cy Paulson, general manager of Best Buy here on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
As we just heard, Black Friday is creeping up on us when Americans flood into stores for creature comforts. And one question we always wrestle with at Marketplace is, do shoppers really save any money? NerdWallet recently published a study on Black Friday that tackles that question and a bunch of others. Matthew Ong is a senior retail analyst there, and he joins me now. Welcome to Marketplace Weekend.
Thank you for having me.
I feel like every year when Black Friday approaches, we sort of do this dance. Are you getting a deal? Are you not getting a deal? Is there any way to know if consumers are really saving money?
The best way for consumers to know is to look at these Black Friday advertisements very carefully and compare these advertisements to things you may have seen last year on Black Friday or earlier this year, and try and have an idea of what these products that you want sell for typically.
You guys did a study about Black Friday that I found pretty fascinating. And one of the things that captured my attention was who is hardest hit by holiday debt. Tell me about that.
We found that middle-income consumers, who we were defining as households making $50,000 to $75,000 in annual income, will actually take longer to pay off their household holiday-incurred debt than both lower-income consumers and wealthy earners.
Do you know why that was? Are people in the lower-income bracket just not buying as much stuff?
Middle-income families are in this odd position this holiday season where they're extended ample credit to make purchases based off their incomes. But when you add up all the rest of the bills and the mortgages, etc., these middle-income consumers don't quite have incomes padded enough to really pay off the bills comfortably. So they end up in a dangerous position, really.
That's so interesting. Did you think when you were working on a study about holiday spending that you would end up telling a story about, you know, what's happened to the middle class in the past 10 years?
No, we definitely didn't expect to see a finding like this in a study just about holiday spending. Middle class can often be more of a lifestyle than an income range. And we see a lot of consumers anecdotally trying to keep up with this middle class lifestyle and maybe really not having the incomes to support it.
There's a part in the study where you say repeated deals aren't only disappointing, they're also problematic. What do you mean by that?
We had observed in the past that a lot of Black Friday ads tend to look the same year after year after year. So we wanted to know, are retailers actually repeating the exact same deals year after year? And the answer is yes.
Really?
Definitively yes. Yes. We looked at, this year we looked at 27 Black Friday advertisements. And we found that at 25 of these stores, so 93%, contain at least one of the exact same item selling at the exact same price as the retailer put in their ad from last year. Not even a new model or an updated model, the exact same item.
So if you buy it a year later, I mean, you factor in inflation, you're actually paying more for the same thing.
For example, Office Depot is selling a printer. The exact same printer that they sold in 2013 for the exact same price in 2014. Because consumers would assume that, you know, another year of printer technology updates, another year of just more innovation, more models on that front would make that model cheaper. According to Office Depot, no.
Wow. Are there any other examples you think of companies sort of tricking us into thinking we are getting a better deal than we are?
Retailers love to trick consumers on Black Friday. It's really a hobby of theirs because they know that Black Friday gets so much press and attention and that consumers will be shopping in stores. So retailers will negotiate exclusive deals with manufacturers months in advance of Black Friday, often on electronics like TVs, things like that, to make these items knockoffs, really, that look a lot like the items you've seen on the shelves in previous months, but actually slightly different with less features, cheaply made, and items that just are a little lower in quality. The item itself is not the same, and that's why the retailers can sell these items for such low prices.
While you were doing all of this research, was there anything you came across where you thought, ooh, that's actually a legit deal, I would buy that?
Absolutely. I believe that Staples has an Asus laptop for about $100. Walmart, I believe, also has a 65-inch TV. That's selling for one of the lowest prices we've ever seen a TV of that size sell for. There are some great deals on Black Friday. Black Friday is about cheap electronics, so if that's the market that you're into, there are some great deals out there. That's one of the reasons that we see young men being the ones that are really driving a lot of the Black Friday madness. It's because young men love cheap things and they love electronics.
Matthew Ong, Senior Retail Analyst for NerdWallet, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Marketplace Weekend is produced by Eliza Mills and Jenny Ament. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer, and Bill Lance is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Next week, we're going to eat some bugs. Yeah, really. And get ready for Cyber Monday. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week. This is APM.